You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Milwaukee's Mitchell Park domes have had problems with falling debris, with repair estimates near $75 million. Coming up, we'll look at a new study that's recommending a pretty drastic alternative. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Wisconsin's Assembly Speaker is rejecting calls to testify as part of a gerrymandering case. Former Governor Scott Walker has taken on some new roles in the public eye, and Superior is moving forward with a plan to clean up one of its major harbors. Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
Well, Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss saying he is not going to testify in this court case over gerrymandering here in Wisconsin. This case has been running for a long time. Why are his lawyers saying he doesn't need to appear before the court?
Right. Well, so Voss was Assembly Speaker in 2011 when these contested maps were drawn. That seems like a long time ago now. But this is still these are ongoing legal cases over those maps. So, you know, in this case, it is true. State lawmakers are generally immune from civil lawsuits in Wisconsin. I guess the idea is that people could sue frivolously or, you know, not because they have a complaint, but just because they want to impede legislation. So that is Voss's side of the argument for why he should not have to testify. This is a civil case. Democrats' argument in this case is that Voss and Republicans have already intervened in related lawsuits. They've already hired outside attorneys, and they're sort of like already in it. and so to choose now to say, well, I don't want to answer these questions seems wrong to them.
And he would be, if he testified, they want him to testify and release documents that were part of the process of creating Wisconsin's maps that are being, voting maps that are being challenged now. Is that right?
Right. So this is the one, you know, at the time that they drew these maps, Voss and the Republican leadership went to great lengths to keep the meeting secret, keep everything secret. They asked lawmakers to, like, sign non-disclosure agreements. This was top secret stuff. So as part of this lawsuit, there are materials related to that, with their lawyers that have been subpoenaed that they don't want to give up.
We're talking to Rob Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Part of our weekly check-in on some of the big stories from around Wisconsin in politics, the economy, and more. Coming up in just a bit, we'll get into another Wisconsin story looking at a landmark in Milwaukee. The Mitchell Park domes in Milwaukee plans to either repair or replace them. We'll get a perspective from historian John Gerda on that. Trying to reconnect with our guest, Rob Mentzer, and boost our phone line a little bit. You can share your thoughts on the domes in Milwaukee, by the way. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and tell us what you think there, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Are you a fan of the domes? Is that a favorite family visit? Is it worth what it would take to replace it or to repair it? Or do you want to see a new similar project maybe in the future? We'll get some thoughts on that coming up as we try to reconnect with Rob Mentzer. Okay, we have Rob back. Sorry, Rob, we wanted to boost your phone line a little bit there. I want to turn to, that's okay, former Governor Scott Walker now has a couple new gigs announced this week. One, he'll be honorary chair of a group pushing for a constitutional convention. What's that all about?
Right, so the name of the group is the Center for State-Led National Debt Solutions, and they want a balanced budget amendment, basically. They want an amendment to the Constitution that would require the federal government not to run a deficit. That would be a big change to the way the federal government does things, but this is the idea.
And Wisconsin has signed on to the group of states. They need a handful more states to do this, to call this constitutional convention. And so I guess Governor Walker would be, part of a cheerleader to get those remaining states to get on board.
Yeah, kind of. And it's considered it's an honorary chairman, but it's sort of a spokesperson role. And it's him getting out in front of an issue that is popular with a certain stripe of Republican, I suppose.
And then on a related note to what we were just talking about, Rob, former Governor Walke will be the finance chair of the National Republican Redistricting Trust. What are their goals?
Right. So, yeah, not to put too fine a point on it, I guess their goals are to try to maintain the hold on power that Republicans put into law when they drew voting maps in 2011. So, you know, what happened, Republicans had a wave election in 2010. They swept into power in Wisconsin, but also across the nation, and they drew, that gave them the power to draw voting maps in a lot of places in 2011. This is, has been the subject of a lot of political fights, but it also objectively has helped Republicans in a number of places, including Wisconsin. And it's become sort of a Democratic platform position to advocate for nonpartisan voting reforms. And this is, a bit of pushback from the Republican side on that, saying that, in fact, Democrats want to gerrymander districts and that we should, I guess, stand firm on the voting maps that we have.
And then, Rob, the Superior City Council voted this week to proceed with an $18.5 million cleanup project for the water in Howard's Bay. What are the kinds of contamination people are worried about there?
Yeah, this stems from a chemical that used to be used in these big ships to prevent barnacles. You got to prevent barnacles on these ships. This was before there was regulation of these things. It has since been outlawed. But there's still a lot of these chemicals have gotten into the water and into the soil in Howard's Bay, part of Lake Superior, and so this is part of a big national cleanup project that's aimed at trying to get some of these chemicals out of that soil. But it's hard; it requires dredging, and this in particular is an $18.5 million cleanup project.
We'll leave it there for now. Rob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, with us for a look at some of the week's news from around the state. Coming up, one new study recommends replacing Milwaukee's Mitchell Park domes with a new building that would also house the public museum. We'll get some reaction here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a line of Boeing planes is grounded and a major order is being canceled after two crashes in recent months. We'll get the latest from an aviation reporter. First, a new study is calling for major changes to two of Milwaukee's deteriorating cultural assets. In 2016, large chunks of concrete fell from the Mitchell Park domes, prompting county officials to close the facility for several months until it could be made safe. That was a temporary fix. Full restoration could cost $75 million. At the same time, the Milwaukee Public Museum is experiencing problems with water leaks, mold, and temperature control. Officials there are working on plans for a new $100 million building. A new study commissioned by the Milwaukee County Museum Task Force is recommending that the domes be torn down and replaced with a brand new building, one that would also house the public museum. Estimated cost $300 million. John Gerda is a Milwaukee historian and author of The Making of Milwaukee. He's also a member of the Domes Task Force. That's a different group working on the issue. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Rob.
Well, what do you think of this recommendation? We, I guess, give up on the domes and combine it with a new building along with a public museum.
There's a lot of confusion out there, and I think it stems from the fact that there are two task forces.
Right.
The idea was floated that the museum and the domes combine, and it's not clear where that came from, but where the recommendation to tear down the domes came from was Gallagher, the consultant for the museum, which is very different from the task force that was charged with coming up with a plan for the domes, and that's the one that's been on since the end of 2016. And I think that's the one that is going to have more traction in a longer tenure. And basically, the reality from the task force I'm on is that there's no appetite for tearing down those domes. We've been through two phases. The first was feasibility. The second was public input. And we narrowed the possibilities down from 8 to 2. So we're kind of narrowing things down a bit. And those two are what we're describing as targeted investments, which will help with everything from classroom space to food service, and the larger one is turning the show dome into what we're describing as an ecological habitat zone. Could include canopy walks, aquaria, live animals, that sort of thing. So what's going on now is the RFPs, the request for proposal, just went out, I think in the last couple of days, for a consultant to help us kind of narrow down the options and be more specific about the comprehensive plan. So that's where things are going. And I think the prospect of those domes coming down, even though, you know, the headline was scary, I think that is not going to be an eventuality.
Now, a lot of people in Wisconsin have visited the domes over the years and decades. For people who haven't, paint us a picture and tell us about the role they play in Milwaukee.
They go back to the years between 1964 and 1967. They were built kind of in stages. There's a show dome where they have changing exhibits. There's a tropical dome. It's actually a rainforest. And a desert dome. So they were at a time after World War II when Milwaukee was really rolling along on kind of a high wave of prosperity and confidence. That's when the zoo was built. The public museum itself was built. The War Memorial Center was built. So a lot of landmarks that are part of the landscape today date from that period. And it replaced, the domes replaced, a Crystal Palace that was built back in 1898 and had fallen on hard times. So they were kind of a reimagination of kind of this horticultural conservatory for the masses. I've described them as a zoo for plants, which is kind of what they have been. One reporter described them as a brassiere manufacturer's model, so they have kind of that going for them as well.
And you, in a recent piece, you dug even further back in the history of bringing plants that are exotic to our part of the world into Milwaukee. Tell us about some of the first efforts that maybe weren't open to the public.
The guy who was the real figure there was Alexander Mitchell, and it's kind of a happy coincidence that the Mitchell Park, that facility and the park around it is named for his family. He was the richest guy in Wisconsin, a banker, railroad tycoon, insurance magnate, and he had a house on the corner of what's now 9th and Wisconsin in downtown Milwaukee, which is now the Wisconsin Club, and it's really in very, very good shape. But he had a greenhouse, a conservatory on his land, on his lot, that he had everything from orchids to fig trees to mushrooms to fruit trees, and he grew carnations, and he would go down to the Commodity Exchange in Milwaukee, and he had a fresh carnation in his lapel every day of the year, including February. So he wasn't known. He's kind of a tight-fisted Scot. He wasn't known as somebody who would spread the wealth around. But at Easter time, he grew lilies, and those would make their rounds of the Protestant churches in Milwaukee. So that really was kind of in some ways, the precursor of the domes of today.
And his conservatory there went away. A descendant wasn't that into it, and there was a big two-thirds off sale and everything.
Yeah, it's sort of like Stein's, you know, after when the seasons have changed. What happened was, you know, he died 1887, I think. His wife Martha moved to Florida, so the house was, you know, just pretty much empty. And what happened was a group of well-heeled Germans organized something called the Deutscher Club, the German Club, and they made that their clubhouse, and that became the Wisconsin Club. It was known as the Deutscher Club until 1917, when it was really a bad idea to be waving the German flag during World War One. So it's been the Wisconsin Club ever since.
And then we had, as you mentioned, the Crystal Palace. Can you talk about the origins of that as a place now where the public could come and see these plants?
And that goes back to 1898, as I said, and it was kind of the vogue in large U.S. cities. There's still one in Chicago, down in Garfield Park on the south side. It's been kind of rehabbed. It's a fashion that began in Europe, you know, so you have these open windows open to the sky, basically, and so you could grow plants very easily, even in a harsh climate. They had to heat those things, you know, burned a lot of coal, you know, keeping those warm in the wintertime. So it was any city of size that was worth its salt, you know, pretty much had to have one of those conservatories. And the problem, of course, you know, is you have this winters can be a bit tough around here, as we've discovered in the last couple of months. Hailstorms aren't especially friendly, you know, for those kinds of structures. So it pretty much began to decline, began to deteriorate, and I think it closed back in about 1956 or so. And it was, even then, you know, there was a commitment to do something that would be more modern, you know, more contemporary. And that's where the domes came from, on the same site. So they didn't fall too far from the tree.
John Gerda is with us, Milwaukee historian, author of The Making of Milwaukee. He's a member of the Domes Task Force. We're looking at the future of the Mitchell Park Domes in Milwaukee. And let's get back to the present day. I want to read a couple of comments from Facebook, the Ideas Network Facebook page. Brandy says they're falling apart and not enough people visit to help finance fixing them. It's a shame. It's the truth. Paul says, though, the dome should be preserved. Milwaukee needs to stop electing the kind of executives who refuse to invest intelligently for the future. A decade and a half of deferred maintenance caused these problems. We owe it to our kids to do better. Let's take Paul's point first there, John. Is this a case where investments weren't made early enough to avoid some of the problems the domes have today?
Without any question. The buildings are 50 years old at this point, and some of the basic maintenance simply was not done. And, you know, the reasons for that, you know, in the more recent years are the county had a pension scandal that pretty much distracted both attention and especially resources, financial resources, you know, for anything resembling maintenance. So right now, no one really knows, but the county parks in Milwaukee have structural problems that would cost something like $300 million to remedy. You know, so this is part of a longer-term pattern, you know, as Milwaukee has struggled. And without decreases in combined, or rather, aid from the state of Wisconsin, you know, so there's been a real kind of a financial shortfall, and that continues to be a crisis, you know, for the county. So, yes, there were things that should have been done a long time ago that we're paying for now.
And we heard from, as I mentioned, Brandy and some others on Facebook saying, we like these, but they're falling apart so much, we probably shouldn't try to save the buildings in their current form. You're not on board with that, it sounds like, John.
No, they're not really falling apart. There's one of the RFPs that went out this week, or the past this week, is for a study of the glazing system, the window system. So we don't really know at this point, you know, kind of what it would take to bring those back to code. And there was netting put in that really, the light still comes through, you know, it doesn't look like an eyesore. And the fix there was good for about 5 years. So it's not dangerous. Everyone should feel welcome to come. So the point is that, you know, we're trying to get something underway, you know, before, you know, that time limit is reached.
And we heard from Mike on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Mike says, make them bigger and better. We could afford to support private business owners by Miller Park and the Fiserv Forum, but we have to tear down a Milwaukee icon. Let's make it bigger and better. So is that an option, not just patching up what's there, but you were actually touching on this earlier, John, expanding and adding to it?
That's one possibility. I think the motion right now, the momentum right now, is toward keeping them keeping the same footprint, keeping the same structures, and enhancing them both operationally and physically. So you'll see the same domes, but right now, you know, they have the studies we did in that first phase. The domes have, I think, of all the comparable attractions in the country, the domes have the smallest ratio of full-time employees to revenue and visitors. You know, so it really is, you know, kind of a bare-bones operation. One thing that frustrates me in the wintertime is it closes at 5, including on weekends. You know, and it can be really magical in after dark at night. And that's something that I think will be part of the discussions going forward. So I think as the term we're using is targeted investments and then making it a destination attraction. So I think the direction here and the message people should certainly receive is that the best is yet to come.
Can you talk about the role of an amenity like this, of the domes, for the community in Milwaukee County?
Yeah, I think what it says is, you know, we're not just a place that has roads and police and fire departments. No, the quality of life is important here, and that's always been. From the way back in the days in the mid-1800s when this was the Deutschhafen, the German Athens of America, you know, there was always this feeling that there was a good reason to invest in public amenities so that people could not just live but enjoy life. And the park system was really, really, and still is, a key part of that. Milwaukee has 15,000 acres of green space inside the county limits, and that is 5 times per capita more than Chicago has. And that's a pretty good system down there in Chicago. So this really was a time, especially when the socialists were in charge, those years between roughly 1910 and 1960, when it was, trying to provide green corridors, the lungs for the masses, respite in the presence of nature for working families. And the park system's absolutely part of that, and the domes are part of the park system.
And, John, Milwaukee's going to get a few visitors next year for the Democratic National Convention later in the summer. Are the domes going to be an accessible option if people want to escape the hubbub and spend some time in the rainforest?
Yes, they will. Yes, they will. Yeah, because we're inside that window, you know, with the netting. So, absolutely. This is kind of on the same subject. I do a column for the Journal Sentinel the first Sunday of each month, and the one coming up in April will be looking at conventions past. And it's interesting, with all the talk about this being kind of this breakthrough event, we've never done it before. We actually have. Milwaukee has hosted conventions much larger than the 50,000 they're talking about that the Democrats will bring in. Back in 1941, the American Legion had its national convention here, and the numbers are slippery, but there may have been as many as 150,000 people here. They slept everywhere, including trunks of cars and kind of on berths in railroads, or railroad cars that were parked, you know, along the lakefront. And the highlight was a parade that lasted for 12 hours.
And wow.
At 40,000 people in the parade and about 400 drum and bugle corps and marching bands. So top that, I guess, is the challenge.
All right, John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
That's John Gerda, Milwaukee historian and author of The Making of Milwaukee. He's a member of the Domes Task Force. We talked with him about the future of the Mitchell Park Domes, repair, the possibility of them being demolished. He doesn't want to see that, and what the future might hold. Coming up, we'll look at the latest news about Boeing and its grounded 737 MAX 8 jet after two crashes involving the plane. Some congressional testimony coming along in the aviation industry on that topic. An aviation reporter joins the show. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 6 on The Morning Show, Eau Claire County may extend a moratorium on new or expanded large-scale livestock operations. Join Kate Archer-Kent and her guests for a look at the reasons behind that moratorium. That's Monday morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, fallout continues from two deadly crashes involving Boeing's 737 MAX 8 jet. Indonesia's national airline announced today it was canceling an order of the aircraft estimated to be worth nearly $5 billion. And both the company and the Federal Aviation Administration are under scrutiny now for how the certification of the plane was handled. Here's President Trump explaining the decision to ground that line of planes last week.
The United States has the greatest record in the world of aviation, and we want to keep it that way. So I didn't want to take any chances. We didn't have to make this decision today. We could have delayed it. We maybe didn't have to make it at all. But I felt it was important, both psychologically and in a lot of other ways.
Lori Aratani covers transportation and the airline industry at The Washington Post. Lori, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Some of the latest developments are in Congress. What are members of Congress in both chambers starting to look at now?
So next Wednesday, we're going to have our first congressional hearing on this. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas is going to have a hearing on Wednesday where he'll have the chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board, which does safety investigations here in the U.S. and is part of the investigation of the Ethiopian Airlines crash. He'll have the Department of Transportation's Inspector General, who U.S. Secretary of Transportation Elaine Chao has asked to begin an audit of the certification process that went into FAA giving the okay for the 737 MAX 8s to begin flying, and he'll also have the acting administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration, Daniel Elwell, there to answer questions. It's not clear how many answers we'll get. It will probably be a lot about the process of what they're going to be doing. The NTSB can't talk a lot about the investigation. We don't know a whole lot yet, but it'll be the first of what will likely be several of them. And Senator Cruz has also said he plans on having hearings later down the line that will have officials from Boeing and other companies there to answer questions.
One thing that seems to be raising concerns is the similarities between the crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia. What are people pointing at?
So people are pointing at there is an automated system that Boeing has put on this new version of the 737. This is your workhorse plane. It's your single-aisle aircraft that lots of people have flown on. It's been flying since 1967, but there have been a lot of changes made to this. This newest version has larger engines, and they're mounted more toward the front, so there's a tendency for the nose of the plane to tip up. Boeing had installed to help compensate that for that. There's a worry that if the nose tips up too much, the plane can stall. I mean, basically fall out of the air. So to compensate for that, they put an automated system on there. Many folks who have been following this story might have heard about it. It's called, they call it MCAS. And the fear is that this automated system was somehow triggered, but there were concerns that pilots weren't necessarily told about this. They may not have trained on it, so it's not clear whether... It's not clear what happened, but they're focusing on this automated safety system. In the investigation, which is still in its early stages, even with the Indonesian flight, which crashed last October, we still don't know exactly what happened. But they did note that both planes crashed shortly after they took off. They had similar patterns when they were through the air that people have sort of described as sort of seesawing, where they're going up and down, and they had difficulty gaining altitude. This was enough information that once the satellite tracking information came out, it prompted China was the first to ground the aircraft, and that was followed shortly after by the European Union, Canada, and then the United States.
Had there been other concerns raised about this system, this compensating system that you were just talking about, or raised by pilots or others outside of these two crashes?
Well, I think after the Lion Air crash, people began talking about this system, and pilots, particularly here in the U.S., began stepping forward and say, hey, no one ever told us about this system. We weren't trained on this system. And some folks talked about, some pilots were concerned because the training they had basically to fly this new version of the jet, I believe, consisted of, someone said, a 59-minute session on an iPad. And so once, in the wake of the Lion Air crash, there were efforts to update the manuals and to do more training. I know both Southwest and American Airlines are getting simulators to help with training on this. They'll get them before the end of the year. But there had been, I believe, there's a secret or a, sort of a confidential system, that reporting system run by NASA, where there had been some pilots that had raised concerns about the system. So yes, that would have been before the Lion Air crash.
But to be clear, as you were saying earlier, these investigations of both the crashes are in early stages.
Yeah.
Nobody involved in them is concluding that this system was the cause of either of those crashes.
Right. And as accident investigators have told us, there's generally never one cause. There's never one thing. There's sort of a series of – there can be a series of things. So, you know, they'll be looking at everything from the mechanics of the airplane. They'll be looking at the software system. They'll be looking at the training that the pilots had. They'll be looking at maintenance, you know, and they'll be looking at the human factor.
We are talking to Lori Aratani. She covers transportation and the airline industry for The Washington Post, looking at the Boeing line of planes that's currently grounded after two crashes in 5 months in Indonesia and Ethiopia. Lori, some people are pointing at the Federal Aviation Administration and its oversight when a new line of planes is involved. There are accusations that maybe a manufacturer like Boeing is doing too much of the testing on their own. What do we know about that?
Yeah, this sort of certification system has gradually evolved over the years, and more of the people that help with the certification come from Boeing. This had been a push by Congress. After 9/11, there were a lot. The FAA had a lot more responsibilities. And so I guess one of the solutions was to try and have the manufacturer be more involved because they had a lot of the expertise, and that the FAA would serve as a backup check. I think as the years have gone on, the manufacturer has. There are concerns right now, and this is what these congressional probes will look in, that perhaps the manufacturer has too much of a say, and maybe FAA doesn't have the staff and personnel to oversee this process the way that they should be doing. So we may see some changes there as Congress and legislators begin to see exactly what went wrong.
What is the process of certifying a new version of an airplane like this? How long does something like that take?
I believe this was a 5-year process for the 737, and it depends. As you mentioned, this isn't a new plane. Some listeners may recall that back in 2013, there were some issues with Boeing's 787, which was its wide-body Dreamliner. They had some issues with battery fires and the lithium-ion batteries. That was a brand-new aircraft, so that's a different process. Because the this is just another version of the 737, even though it's a 5-year process, that's a shortened process because it's not an entirely new airplane. It's just a revision of that. And so there will be questions. I think there are some questions now that perhaps, you know, there wouldn't be as much training required because it's not a new plane. It's just another version of a plane that pilots have been flying since 1967. So I think that's what they're going to be looking at. It's a little shorter if you're just revising an aircraft, and that's sort of the bonus of updating versus reinventing. And it wouldn't have the same scrutiny that, say, the Dreamliner, which was just going into service, did.
Lori Aratani is with us from the Washington Post, talking about the latest on Boeing after the second deadly crash involving the same model of one of its airplanes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this process of certifying a new type of plane or a new permutation of an existing plane? What do you think about the U.S. waiting to ground the Boeing 737 MAX a few days after the countries? Are you concerned about the FAA's independence from the airline industry and the oversight it provides? What do you want to see Congress asking about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Lori Aratani of The Washington Post, looking at the Boeing aircraft involved in two fatal crashes in less than 5 months. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction after this second crash involving Boeing's 737 MAX airplane? Does it make you worried about airplane safety? What do you think about how the FAA handled the decision to ground that line of planes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Lori, let's get into that decision to ground these planes around the world and here in the U.S. As you mentioned, we were among the last. Big picture, usually we're the country, as I understand it, that other countries look to make these kind of decisions.
We definitely are, and there is some concern worldwide, I think, that perhaps the FAA may have lost some of its stature, its standing in the civil aviation community. China, as you might recall, was the first country to come out and ground the planes, and I think initially some folks may have dismissed that as a little bit of politics. You know, China also has an aviation industry. They have their version of the 737 that they're trying to sell around the world, and this would certainly – trouble at Boeing would certainly help them. But then China was quickly followed by Great Britain, by the EU, and then that was on Tuesday, and then by Wednesday, Canada had stepped in and said they were grounding it. Canada was very good because they actually were one of the few countries that gave actual very clear reasons why, and they talked about the similarity in the flight patterns of these planes before they went down. And shortly, I think just a few hours after Canada announced, the U.S. announced that they were grounding the planes.
Was anybody making the case that these other countries were overreacting, that the FAA was maybe right to hold off on that decision?
I think it depends. It depends where you come from. Analysts have told us that for other countries, even though the 737 is probably the most widely flown plane around the world. This version, there aren't that many out there. There are about 371, I think, that were flying. So for other countries, people said perhaps, you know, it's not as much of an economic question for them. These were perhaps small parts of other airlines' fleets, so it isn't as disruptive. You know, other folks say you got to trust the FAA. You know, they don't just make these decisions lightly. You know, they are a safety agency. They are responsible for aviation safety. And they point out that, you know, it's a very, very safe system. The U.S. has a very safe system. But I think once other countries began tipping in, I guess the pressure was on the U.S. to do something. A lot of countries had said that now once these planes are ready to come online, they are going to be doing their own certification process. I understand that's a break from protocol because generally they would take the FAA at their word. There was also an issue when these planes were initially certified to begin flying. There were the European Union, had expressed some concerns about some of the issues about training and the plane in general, but they were ultimately persuaded to follow the FAA. Brazil was interesting, though, in that they actually wanted additional training for their pilots. They didn't just take the FAA's word. They had some issues, and so they asked for additional training for their pilots and material from Boeing before they would let the plane start flying.
Want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. When certain airline model is so popular, it just put pressure on airlines and regulators, say, hey, we've got to keep these going, otherwise they're going to be growing pretty much the whole fleet. Whereas if they said, well, okay, well, you can have this many of a certain model, then at least there'd be some airliners flying.
Dennis, thanks for the call. So is there, a concern that a particular kind of plane might be too big to fail? If it's such a big part of a fleet, regulators might be reluctant to do something like ground it, Lori?
I think regulators are always going to be concerned about safety. There are certainly economic pressures. You know, airlines have to cancel flights. You know, they don't have these planes in their fleets. It's causing trouble there. But ultimately, for regulators, it is about safety.
Thanks for the call, Dennis. We'll go now to Terry with us in Milton. Terry, hello.
Hi. I had gone on the checked on the airworthiness directives that were put out by the FAA. And they said that this aircraft also had problems with the vertical stabilizers and that they had a condition that could cause the flight crew to have difficulty controlling the airplane and lead to excessive nose-down attitude, significant altitude loss, and a possible impact with the terrain. That was taken right off the airworthiness directives that came from the FAA.
Terry, thanks for the call. You had mentioned that tipping forward problem. That's what the software was supposed to be solving, Lori. Have you heard concerns like Terry is raising there?
That sounds like the airworthiness directive that the FAA put out, or that Boeing put out shortly after, my names here. It's been a long week. That was shortly after the Lion Air crash. And yes, there is a concern. That is a concern. And that was a warning to pilots so that they know they are trained how to handle a situation like that. MCAS was designed to make it easier for them because it would do it. It would kick in automatically. But pilots are trained to do this. So the airworthiness directive, I believe, was just a reminder to pilots that this is a risk so that they needed to know, to be sure that they knew what to do in the case that something like this happened.
Thanks for that call, Terry. We're talking to Lori Aratani from The Washington Post. She covers transportation in the airline industry, looking at Boeing planes, the one involved in two crashes now in the last 5 months, the decision to ground it by the FAA. We'll go back to your calls now. Randy is with us in Ripon. Randy, hi.
Hi. I can't help but wonder if this is indicative of all the underfunding of government agencies not having enough staff and everybody to test and regulate. I mean, for the airline to self-regulate, it seems like a huge contradiction. Interest and And I worry. I mean, we're taking a trip here in April. And I'm scared out of my mind to fly. If I hope I'm not in one of those planes.
Randy, thanks for the call. Is there a concern that regulation is underfunded, Lori?
I think there's definitely a concern about whether FAA has enough people on their staff to do what they need to do, given all the responsibility that agency has. There's also concern about experience, right? You want folks that are experienced and are up to date in all these different systems. And a lot of times there's that tug and pull, you know, for folks that are starting in these careers. You can go to private industry and often make a lot more money than you can in government. So I think there's also the question of, you know, are the folks that the FAA is able to attract, are they able to retain them? Do they have the right experience? Do they know these systems? Are they up to date?
Thanks a lot for the call. But that said, Lori, flying is fairly safe these days compared to, I think, what I remember when I was growing up. And it seemed like crashes happen way more often than they do now.
Flying is incredibly safe, and it's the, you know, you're much, they people often remind me as a transportation writer and someone who covers things that move, that you're in more risk when you get in your car every day than you are in getting on an airplane. It's just that when airplanes so rarely go down these days, as you mentioned, and when they do, it's a lot of people's lives are at risk. They're large numbers here, so I think that's why they get attention. But yes, I think the U.S. had not had an aviation fatality. I think last year we had the Southwest jet, but that was the first one in many, many, many years.
Let's go to the top now, the FAA. We have a new nominee to head the FAA. How long have we been with an interim appointment there?
We have been with an interim appointment for about a little over a year. Dennis Huerta, who was the last FAA administrator, left in January at the end of his five-year term. There was a lot of talk. President Trump had talked about how he wanted his personal pilot to run the FAA, and I think there was some pushback on that. But now we have someone who is a former Delta Airlines executive who himself was a pilot, and so he will go through the confirmation process, and we'll see if we can get some permanent leadership there.
Is this something that's usually a pretty smooth sailing process? Do we usually confirm our FAA appointees?
Generally, I can't recall a time when this has been a particularly controversial appointment. This administration always surprises, but I think he is generally well-regarded. He certainly has the support of the Transportation Secretary, Elaine Chao, has spoken very highly of him, as has Dennis Huerta, who was the previous FAA administrator.
And briefly, Lori, as we wrap up, what are you watching for next as this story goes on?
I think the next thing is going to be Boeing is supposed to implement a software patch that's going to help with this automated anti-stall system. So we're waiting for the announcement of what that's going to be. You know, the question for many people is how long is this going to last? I think we're going to be looking out to see what investigators turn up. There is some talk that we could get at least some preliminary investigation, some preliminary findings about the Ethiopian air crash as early as next week.
Lori, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Lori Aratani, transportation reporter for The Washington Post, with us to talk about the latest news surrounding Boeing after two crashes in less than 5 months killed more than 300 people. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, NPR has confirmed the news that Attorney General William Barr received a report from Justice Department Special Counsel Robert Mueller. We'll have the latest on what we know and don't know at this point on Monday. Lots of people are incarcerated around the United States. A new report breaks down the numbers among federal and state prisons and local jails and tries to tackle some myths about incarceration along the way. Restaurants in communities around Wisconsin are having trouble finding people to work at them. The head of the state's Restaurant Association tells us how that's affecting business. And a high-profile homicide in New York is bringing new attention to the mafia. A guest tells us the organization has changed very significantly in a lot of different ways, but it hasn't gone away. All that and more, it's coming up Monday right here on Central Time.